Well, I think that's very common among people who, you know, hold themselves in high esteem. They don't like to suffer fools gladly.
QSO. And even if that is for money and personal gain.
Yeah, I don't think they were quite driven for money. I think they did these things, again, a lot of times out of a need to kind of do them. Although Michelangelo, his jobs were commissioned, so I don't think he did much for free and then tried later to find someone to sell it to. It wasn't that type of a world. You looked for commissions and you picked... You picked and chose, but he was a little notorious. You know, at the tomb of Pope Julius II, he had some pieces that he never finished. The sculpture, the Medici Madonna, the Bandanini Pietà. There were a bunch of things he just never kind of finished up on. So again, not quite sure what was going on there. You know, if he was just interested in getting the money. He probably would have completed them because he got into trouble for uncompleted works. But that was his little bit of Michigan.
His last works were made in candlelight. I don't know if it was his very last breath of life. And it's quite amazing how he trained himself to accomplish these things. He trained himself by studying the anatomy of monks in the temple.
Okay. Well, you know, a lot of other... artists kind of used the same methods as the monks. There was a kind of free exchange of information and such. But I think it's the Rodinini Pietà. That was his last work, which he never was able to finish. He worked on it from 1552 to 1554, apparently. There's that. He did beautiful stuff, but you know, the Sistine Chapel is still there to be gazed at. He probably could have produced more if he was avaricious, but I don't think that's what drove him.
Well, he produced a lot of work, and for all of his life, you know, he produced, I would say, very recognizable, very known work that became rather universal in the world of art and religious art.
Yes, yeah, he's famous to this day, and his name will live on for probably many, many centuries to come, whereas a lot of other people have come and gone.
Well, you know, I went to Italy, I think it was 1998, 99, I don't remember the exact year, to see, you know, all of these artworks. There was some in Rome, there was some in Milan, there was some in Florence, you know, quite an amazing sight.
Yeah, it's a very historical country. It has a long history. It goes back to, you know, into the BC days. The Roman Republic predates, you know, a lot of things, and it has a lot of history. You don't quite get that in New York. Some parts of New York, the architecture is beautiful, the art is beautiful, but it's relatively new. Everything that you might want to look at is at best a couple of centuries old. There are places you can go in Italy that are thousands of years old. the Colosseum for one.
Well, my memory of Italy in terms of art and creative things and religion, you know, it gave me a very romantic feeling. It was very romantic. It's like when you go to Rome and you see the cobblestone bricks in the road, and you realize that it could have been from a time when there was the Colosseum, you know, there was some kind of activity related to the place so many years ago.
Yeah, I have a question also.
Yes, Wesley.
Yeah, when you were talking to, I was thinking to autistic people could be very good in math. Absolutely amazing. Often. There are a lot of geniuses who had deficiency, some sort of deficiency. Do you think that to avoid that there is a genius who doesn't have any deficiencies, or the worst one, like you?
Well, I think there are geniuses that don't have significant, obvious flaws. You know, other than what they're a genius in, they're kind of an average, regular person. You're kind of talking about idiot savants, and the autistic can do amazing things. But it's for some weird reason, it's vaguely similar to things like artificial intelligence. You can teach an autistic person who has the ability to reproduce any music. You know, you could play a song on a piano, and they will play it back exactly the way you gave it to them. There's no kind of interpretation or adjustments made. They're just kind of reproductive devices. So there's not any inherent creativity. They simply, their brains are wired in such a way that they can repeat something that they experience. So I wouldn't quite call that a genius, you know, even if they're mimicking a genius's work. Autistic people, I generally don't consider the way that they demonstrate their abilities are more recording devices than instruments of creation. You know, some geniuses are deeply flawed, you know, crazy even. And some are sane. I don't think you necessarily have to be insane or to be particularly damaged in some other way to make it up by being a genius in another. I think, unfortunately, people who are discerned to be geniuses are often coddled and given permission to kind of overdo things, and they tend to, you know, kind of become very eccentric, given a chance. But there are others, documented people of genius, that simply, you know, did their thing. They were a little on the obsessive side, but I think that kind of goes hand in hand with a genius in a particular field. But otherwise, you know, not, they weren't necessarily mad or damaged in any way.
You know, I think about genius as you described. And the idea is that genius has to fit in to the scheme of things, the world of money, the world of expectation, the world of conflict and competition.
Well, not necessarily in real time. There are many artists that died in poverty, and I think they committed suicide often. They were not truly appreciated until a different time. So again, you are not necessarily known for your genius in your lifetime. Some forms of genius are a little bit more subtle than other forms. You know, if you're, there was a Indian kid that self-taught mathematics, And he did a lot of sophisticated stuff. Professor who immediately had him come to the United Kingdom, and he wrote a lot of papers and made a lot of fame, and unfortunately soon after he died of tuberculosis. But a genius comes in all kinds of shapes and sizes, and some are obvious and some are arguments of whether such and such is a genius or just a gifted and talented artist.
So the person that's making the judgment, they say this person is genius. How would they know if they're not also a genius?
Well, you don't necessarily have to be a genius to appreciate, if there's a very difficult problem in physics, quantum mechanics, or relativity, in mathematics. There are a lot of problematic areas. There's different infinities. Unfortunately, most of us think infinity is just a concept. But there are different types of infinity. At the point that they were doing number theory, they had run out of Greek letters, and so they went back to Hebrew, and so there is there's an infinity set called Aleph. Aleph Null is the lowest infinity set, and the highest one is Aleph Naught Aleph. People regularly, you and I wouldn't have the faintest idea what the hell that's about. But, guys who aren't quite a genius but are gifted in mathematics see that and say, that's a profound discovery you've made. Basically, you're a genius. So you can appreciate people smarter than you. You can appreciate people stupider than you. So, it's not impossible for a non-genius to qualify someone as a genius. Sometimes they get it wrong. Sometimes, again, they're just gifted but not quite genius. And there's no real meter to put on anything on. You can't kind of, have someone stick their finger in a box and measure their genius level. So it's always, to a degree, a reflection of human society.
Yeah, I think it's all about fitting in to status quo, what's accepted, the world of money, competition, and conflict. If people had there was an avenue, to be free to do their thing, whatever the creative thing is, and without this competition to get more and more, and to put a label on it, this is what I think it is, then maybe, creativity would take another form, and I think it would have much more value.
I have a cliche comment on it.
Yes, Wesley?
Isn't it because of our perception that we assign features to another person, extraordinary features? Say, in 1830, we had Samuel F.B. Morse. Do we think about him as a creator of Morse alphabet, inventor, or the genius? Most likely we think about him as an inventor. We have a Marconi, and we have December 12, 1901. He transmitted Morse code signals across the Atlantic Ocean from Porthcawl, Cornwall, England, to St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada. And that was, I'm not sure how, but say 3,500 kilometers. Over 2,000 miles, 2,100 miles. Was he genius? No, we think he was an inventor. Then we talking about Thomas Edison. For many people, Thomas Edison was a crook. Was a guy who actually did everything to make Tesla suffer. But it was a crook who actually used people to claim benefits given by other people. He was a businessman, right? Okay. Was he genius? No, we don't think he... I don't believe anyone think that Thomas Edison was a genius. Then we have Edison. Then we have E=MC². The Jewish guy who was working in patent office, and he had an access to somebody's data, somebody's inventions, and all of a sudden he became famous. Was he genius? He's pretty much known. So the only guy that I know that I can recall from the recent time, from 20th century, who was like a virgin. Nobody actually said the word, anything wrong about him or any conspiracy theory about him, was Tesla. Was it true, Dr. Roy?
No, I would disagree. I'm confused. I think Tesla was a genius, but I think a lot of people had arguments with him. The whole thing between DC and AC was an argument that he dealt with. He dealt with a lot of arguments. There was a lot of doubt because, again, he behaved kind of in a quirky way. So it kind of makes people wonder. I certainly think Einstein was a genius. I mean, the man basically changed our understanding of space-time and quantum mechanics. And he went on to write very, very important papers into the 1950s. Unfortunately, you know, most people who get Nobel Prizes in subjects, it's based on research. Einstein, to me, is the most obvious case of a genius. His ideas revolutionized physics. Physics was in a sad condition. Newtonian physics had generated a lot of unsolvable problems, and he addressed them in two very fundamental ways, with relativity and with quantum mechanics. So, also, as I tried to say before, He went on being productive into his old age, which is somewhat unusual. Physicists do their best work in their 20s and their 30s and kind of glide through the rest of their professional careers often, but Einstein didn't. So I, if anyone's a genius, I think Einstein was.
Okay. When you talk about Guglielmo Marconi, we think about beginning of everything. We are ham radio operators operating on ham radios because of the first guys who were playing with radio waves. But then, of course, there was Bolinas, California, and Marconi Station that was taken over by RCA in 1918, right? And then we're talking about the Nobel Prize. Nobel Prize wasn't revoked from Marconi, but invention of radio was revoked from Marconi and given to Tesla after Tesla was already dead. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
Okay, my understanding of Nobel Prizes is they don't retract them. You know, you could get the Nobel Peace Prize and kill a bunch of people and you still have your Peace Prize. So I don't think they do that. There are other prizes that are revoked, but that isn't the case. Marconi, to me, was more of a promoter than a scientist, and I don't think he was a genius. Again, I think he was a very effective promoter. You know, he promoted himself, and he was an entrepreneur, vaguely similar to Edison in many aspects. So I wouldn't quite term Marconi to be a genius, just an effective promoter and a tinkerer and inventor, and But I think he got into trouble, and that's how RCA basically got everything that he owned.
Okay, thank you very much. That was my few cents about it, being a genius, inspired by Dr. Roy. Thank you very much, Antoine.
Okay, very good, Wes. Thank you for participating. Any other comments anyone wants to make on the subject?
Yes, I want to say that genius, has to function in this world and also in some other world, a world unknown. When I say the world unknown, the work that they're doing, it doesn't exist yet, So they created in their minds, they have to create this thing physically, either words, essays, objects, other kinds of functioning material.
Well, I don't know. I'd rather make it more simple and just that geniuses tend to ultimately change our perception of the world. So it's not that we create, world B and we're from world A. It's that we start off in world A and the geniuses' understanding of things kind of shift our position into a, a different understanding. Prior to Einstein, everything was Newtonian physics. There was a particular frame of reference of time in the universe where time was immutable. But after Einstein, we understand that time is relative, and the flow of time is relative. So some parts of the universe are at one time, others at other times, and the rate of their clock is different from position to position based upon time-space distortions. And, before Einstein, no one had that perception. It was time was immutable and unchanging, which it doesn't if you understand what relativity teaches us.
Yes. Genius sees the world as another functioning picture. The picture is there. They can create from that, and then they can bring it into the world as it is known, and the possibility of making money, promoting, sharing ideas, offering assistance, it could be in this world, from some other picture, some other perception of a reality.
Yeah, but the first world doesn't remain. That might be the case if you had the, Newtonian world and you have the quantum mechanical world. But there's no more Newtonian world. We use Newtonian equations as simplifications. Somehow something's repeating itself through me, so I don't know what's going on with that. Anyway, so it's just you only get one world. So I, although it's a nice way of describing it, ultimately, I think once And it wasn't a immediate thing either. Newtonian physics had a lot of fans, a lot of professors with degrees in physics discounted quantum mechanics. They thought it was silly and nonsense.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
I hope I'm not timing out things. But, you know, I mean, among the, especially in Germany at the time, there were a lot of cranky Nazis who kind of dismissed quantum mechanics and relativity as Jewish nonsense physics. So it didn't kind of take everyone. Like I said, some of the fundamental brilliant people who gave part of their understanding to relativity, like Lorentz, didn't believe in relativity, and you know his some of his mathematics was proving the whole theory. So you know physics and science in general is not quite as clean as most people are taught in school. You know, they're kind of taught that this was discovered and this was invented and this was discovered and this was invented, and it's a nice straight line and no one fights and no one goes to court and sues everyone, which is what in real life they do. You know, poor Edwin Thompson, a brilliant electrical engineer, invented super regenerative receivers, super heterodyning, and unfortunately ended up penniless. He got his money from court after he jumped out of a window. So, you know, some stories are great, some stories are terrible, but, you know, life ultimately is a messy thing.
Yeah, this world, as it is, it doesn't change. Most of what's in it basically the same. When somebody creates some innovative, interesting invention, either words or objects or radio electronics, you know, that it doesn't quite change the world as it is. It may enhance it, offer some kind of entertainment. And, you know, if you look at the social media or television or anything like that, you realize that it's the same as it was before. Maybe there's more stuff packed in there, but essentially it's the same.
Well, I would tend to disagree. Human beings' natures always kind of remain the same. Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of it is hardwired. So if you take it as a very self-centered type of look, conceiving of the world as basically just the human beings or yourself, yeah, it is. I don't know how much they change. But so the world and behaviors and events do have a marked change. You can easily see the world before the Internet and after the Internet. You could walk down any street, you could kind of thumb through any recent book, and it's touched so much of our society and the way we deal with each other. It's unfortunately introduced a kind of a loneliness and a social isolation, but also a kind of at-your-tips, easy, quick answer to questions that may or may not be correct. It's had a marked effect on our culture, and will have for a long, long time, as far as I can see. So, again, human nature remains unchanged. You basically have to re-engineer humans if you want their nature to change. But technology will impact their culture and the world around.
Yes, and because the media is what it is, and that it influences us, you know, as far back as painting of a Last Supper, some Italian artists like Michelangelo and such, you know, had this idea they want to make the world a better place, and they want to create great artwork, great inventions, so that they can make a difference, because they didn't like what they saw in the world as it was back then and today also.
Okay, but, you know, I mean, that kind of whips around to an early point that you made. There are some people who invent things, but they don't really go anywhere. They don't test them out. They don't promote them. You know, Michelangelo's books were encoded so that most people who looked at it wouldn't even know what the hell it was about. So, you know, he might have invented it, but he didn't change almost anyone because no one else knew about it. You know, it never was brought into being. It was just a concept. He had an idea. Some of them were highly unlikely because of materials that were available and the weight of the object, and the mechanics didn't quite work right. So a lot of what Michelangelo was doodled would have come to nothing anyway. But some of it might have influenced society a lot more if he didn't encode it and hide it.
Well, you know, you can say that artists want to make the world a better place. Maybe they could do that if they spent less time in the world of competition and conflict and money. They spend less time thinking about money and less time competing. You know, they can be more productive. Maybe there are people who are dedicated to make the world better. They don't get involved in so many business deals, you know. Maybe a few here and there, hopefully that's enough to keep them going.
Well, like all things, it depends. There are artists out there who are quite creative, but very greedy. Picasso was one. You know, ultimately, he would just scrawl nothing on a piece of paper and hand it to someone and expect money in return. So yeah, others are driven, even though they're penniless and they're not able to sell anything, they still draw it because they're obsessed with it and they have to do it. So they do it for some inner reason rather than simple things like greed or fame. So again, it sort of depends on the individual. You have examples of the full spectrum of genius out there.
You know that Picasso painted toga parties in the very beginning of his career in the university, and he was a production artist. He worked, you know, worked to make money and, you know, to find fame, and he was quite successful.
Yes, he was. But again, part of that obviously was he was driven by, he liked money, and he liked things that you could buy with money, or people that you could buy with money. So, you know, I mean, his was not a kind of pure artistic obsession. His was a means to an end, and he kind of abused it towards the end. You know, there was all kinds of real dubious stuff that I don't think he had any creative interest in. It was just a means of paying for his lunch or his dinner or something.
What would you say that an artist could be one or the other, but not necessarily both?
I think there's a spectrum. I think there's a range. You know, there are people out there who try to only make money. You know, ultimately the purest form of that are people who counterfeit other people's art. But I think it goes the full range. I think there are people who, if they weren't going to get paid, would have generated a lot less art than they did being well paid for their work.
Well, you know, if you did something else for a living and you have a huge body of work that you keep in storage, you know, and later on in life towards the middle or the end, you want to sell to some major institution, you know, that this is also possible. Maybe people could create and not obsess to the money so much, and perhaps you know, the world will recognize this work and it could make a difference.
Perhaps, you know, I mean, again, I think genius and artists in general come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. I forget the name. There was a guy who just kind of cranked them out ultimately. He was relatively successful, but, you know, he wasn't one of those guys that he sold his paintings for millions of dollars. I think he sold them for, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000, and he basically set up a company where, you know, he kind of outlined some canvases and had students kind of fill the rest of them in, and it just became a means to make a profitable business out of it. And, you know, he kind of commercialized it. And I forget his name, but I don't know, some guy, I think, on the West Coast.
Not Marcus Dobby?
No, I don't think so.
Was it Rothko?
I don't think so. Again, I'm not quite 100% sure, but I don't believe those are the guys. I mean, he like he generated these pictures that you would end up seeing copies of them in hotel rooms and such. It was all over the damn place. But again, not a expensive stuff, but profitable for him, the way he kind of automated the whole process.
Yeah, but I think even a number of artists did the same thing. You know, Kostabi had a studio on 24th Street, West Side, and he invited us to come up into his studio, look around. He even had like a stage where, you know, performances of music. He had storage of, I don't know, many, many works of his. Very recognizable production artist. Same with Rothko. Rothko, you know, he made so many similar works, you know, with variations. And he's very well known and known to be successful.
Okay, I think the guy's name was Thomas Kincaid.
QSL. I don't know him, but I'll look him up.
Okay, he was very popular, made a lot of money, he really had a production method. You know, he cranked them out.
Yeah, if you try to make money doing it that way, you might as well be an accountant.
Well, I think he figured out that he could make a lot more money than an accountant could.
Or a doctor?
Or even a doctor. You know, doctors who turn to the dark side of the force make a lot more money than doctors who stay being doctors. You got Dr. Oz, who promoted quack cures, and I think he's worth something like $200 billion. You know, most doctors aren't worth $200 billion. Or you got the Indian guy who came up with quantum medicine, which is nonsense. I think he's worth something like $300 or $400 million. So, you know, if you turn to the dark side, there's a lot more money to be made than if you just save people's lives.
Well, you could talk about Elon Musk and his opinion and point of view about doctors.
Well, thankfully, I'm unaware. He has a lot of very strange ideas, so it really wouldn't affect me one way or the other. You know, it would be a kid, unfortunately, telling me what some streetless guy, homeless guy, is yelling at the crowd. I've seen interviews. He's relatively delusional on many topics. You know, he will... Yeah. With a straight face, tell the interviewer that he knows more about this, that, and the other thing than anyone else in the world. So he's got problems. I don't know if they're drug-induced or personal or has something to do with his upbringing, because his father's a little unusual and has a very bad reputation. So, you know, that and the price of a bus fare will get me someplace. So I don't really care what his opinions are about pretty much anything. He's not particularly bright. I keep trying to explain to people that this genius stuff is nonsense. If he's a genius, he's a genius of fooling people, because most of the things, the ideas that have been effective have been ripped off by other people, and he basically BS'd people hyping stocks and such. Anyway, I don't want to spend too much time deriding him, because he's not worth it.
Yes, sir. Well, you know, that is, in this world, as we know it, of money and competition and conflicts and whatever, you know. And like you're describing person that can fit perfectly into the world as we know it, the known, and perhaps, you know, it's like, how to say, the artist, the creative person, and the engineer. The engineer sees a breakthrough when the artist understands the language of the engineer.
Okay.
Yeah. The engineer only sees things in the way that is known. And the known is money, the conflicts and competition and technology as it is known. And the artist can understand the language of the engineer, so the engineer thinks that it's a breakthrough.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily stereotype engineers. I once heard an interview from the most junior professor, I think it was at Stanford, in physics, and he said, unfortunately, since he was the newest guy there, they put him in charge of the box. The box was a enclosure that contained crank letters of people who claimed that they had discovered that Einstein was wrong and the true nature of the universe. And so they would mail it to Stanford, and they would put it in the box and give it to this poor guy until he was a little bit more senior. And a lot of those letters came from people who were engineers of one type or another. Some engineers have enough fundamental knowledge to be able to imagine solutions to problems that are incredibly wrong, but people who weren't engineers are less familiar with technology and such. So, I wouldn't stereotype engineers. Some engineers are brilliant and wonderful, delightful, helpful, and some engineers are kind of tedious. But so are some accountants and some lawyers and some doctors. It's the human condition that is fundamentally shaping us all, not necessarily our profession.
Yes, sir. If the world is as it is, good or bad, maybe the world is a terrible place today, according to what we know. And perhaps, people, they go to school, they learn, according to the books and the record of what their field of study is, and the field of study according to what is known. And the question is, can they step out of that world, the constraint of that world, to discover and to find, invent, innovate something else?
A few can, most people can't. People's imagination are limited. Their understanding of the underlying principles are limited too. And most people will tend to accept what they're taught. There's always going to be contrarians out there, though, that will not believe anything that they're taught. Just again, to confuse the universe with human nature. But it's very common because you have to have a foundation. If you have absolutely no foundation, if you decide you're going to reimagine the laws of physics from the very bottom, you know, unless you're incredibly gifted, you're going to fail at that. It's too high a climb. But there are people out there that are capable of it, and many of them are the ones we talk about genius.
Yes, sir, you're absolutely correct. It's like a musician. Musician has to learn music theory. They have to learn technique on the instrument of their choice. So first they have to go through that before they can step out and do something different.
Yeah, you have to kind of learn the rules before you can relatively safely break them.
Yes, sir. I think that is correct.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, again, that's the nature of things. You know, the problem, again, are people who have no foundation, and they base their bizarre beliefs basically on kind of talking to themselves. There's an actor who has kind of a run-through podcast with the tagline, the two times two, one times one equals two. That's his line. He has no fundamental understanding of mathematics or science of any kind. I don't think he graduated high school, but because he was a successful actor, he gets podcast time. And a lot of people have kind of come and kind of said, well, there's got to be something in it. I mean, the guy's on the podcast. But unfortunately, it's just the gibberish of a probably mentally ill gentleman.
Yes, sir. But you know that any person, you know, with half an ability to upload podcasts, you know, they can post their own podcast. Any person, you don't need to be hosted for that.
No, you don't, and a lot of people aren't, or it's very easy to get hosted. It's difficult to make money, but again, if you scratch some audience's itch, you know, they'll stick around, and you'll get AdSense money if it's YouTube, and they make a living. I mean, unfortunately, you have pseudo-political podcasters that believe that Charles Charlie Kirk was a setup from the inside. And I think the person promoting that used as a proof that she had a dream where Charlie told her this in her dream. So that's proof. So, and she makes a lot of money on podcasts because people are entertained. You know, she says that the Prime Minister of France's wife is actually a guy. She's had children. It's kind of obvious that she isn't the guy, but and people give her money for that. So there's a lot of strange things going on.
Well, I'm under the realization that media as it is somehow connected to the world as it is. The media, and you would say, well, there really isn't anything sensible or useful or entertaining, you know, that, how to say, it has a no value. And even back in the day when cable TV, you know, first made its debut, we had it in the basement. I look at 57 channels. I couldn't find anything to watch. I was bored to death. There was nothing interesting there. So, yeah, you know, I think that even today, and it is lacking as far as I am concerned.
that 60 channels, it's like the old song, you know, 60 channels on TV and nothing to watch. But now you have something like 200 channels of all kinds, streaming services, and you could watch anything, anytime on the streaming services. You don't have to wait for scheduled showings of such. And still, for the most part, there's nothing to watch. I think the problem recently about the deteriorating condition of movies and television shows is that they need a lot more writers than they ever did before, and there's only so many competent writers out there. Unfortunately, I've read more than a few biographies and autobiographies of movie and television writers, and gee, did they have a sick childhood. I mean, you know, the guy who did Babylon 5, the science fiction television show, wrote an autobiography, and his grandmother sexually abused him. His mother threw him off the roof as a child, 4 years old or something. His father left. His grandfather beat him up. He was just a mess. So he was a very good writer. He still is. So apparently, and there's a lot of other writers who've had really weird growing up stories that, you know, if any of that would happen to me, I would probably just kind of sit there in the corner of a room and just sob for the rest of my life. But, you know, they wrote pretty good stuff. You know, the guy who did NYPD Blue, I think, he went on a weird spree shotgunning a patrol car. When he was a teenager, he got thrown out of Harvard because of that.
QSL. How to say television and media. I tried to think what I wanted to say. That they're so linked to money. So linked to the world of money and, you know, what people like, ratings and revenue. And it doesn't interest me so much. You know, I have to really look hard to find something to do in terms of interest, creativity. I think, you know, if I can get more humidity into my apartment, I could play guitar more.
Okay, you know, everyone has their own needs and their wants and desires and what have you. The amount of money that a movie makes is a curiosity to me, but it doesn't affect whether I'll go and see it. Doom did very well. The original movie Doom did not do well. I still saw that because I read the original book. And the series that it was extended to, and I just love the idea and the world building. And so for me, you know, how much Doom made in the box office is not as important as that it was derived from a book that I loved. So, yeah, businessmen are certainly interested in profit. It's a business. That's what they're doing it there. They're not doing it for the joy of creation. They're doing it for the joy of cashing a check. And I understand that, and hopefully they could leave enough space for interesting creative products, give them a chance and see what happens. Occasionally there are things that do not look at all profitable. No one in their right mind would think that it's, you know, profitable. People are strange. And over the years, you know, Buckaroo Banzai in the Fifth Dimension, sounded like a travesty. It sounded like a joke. But over the years, it became a reasonably good cult favorite and made a bunch of money. So you're never quite sure what makes money. The public is can be perverse at times.
QSL. Well, you know, on the corner of the street, there was two rows of... What does that call that? Where union workers with their gear for filmmaking on the corner of the street,
for Sex and the City in the middle of the block. And I look around, I said, you know, I'll never watch this movie. And then I went up to one of them and I asked them, you know, do you know why they have so much equipment, such a big production? He says, no. I said, well, it's because they want to take more money off the top. You know, people want to make more money, so they make a bigger production. I said, what would it be like if you had a good quality DSLR camera and a light? You put the light on there, and you can make a great movie with just that.
And some producers and some directors do that, and that's sometimes that's a gimmick. You know, that this entire movie was made on a prosumer mirrorless camera. But usually professionals like to use professional equipment, and professional equipment goes for a heavy markup. It's a little bit easier to use. It's a little bit more dependable. Not probably worth the markup, but, you know, it's just money. So, you know, some people like to do fancy things. You know, they want to have those weird images that, you know, the camera goes all the way up and circles around and all kinds of tricks of the trade. And other people like to keep it simple. Again, there are different times where each approach is reasonable and gives you good results, but you know, they don't all do the same thing. I mean, there are some projects, if you're going to do Lawrence of Arabia, you can't use a VCR for that. You know, you just can't.
Well, you know, DSLR. You can use a DSLR, and it's good, you know, because the you spend a lot less money producing the movie, and, you know, people become interested in the content, and the content also becomes more important than maybe you can make a lot of money anyway.
Again, it sort of depends. I mean, you've seen Lawrence of Arabia, right?
Yes, sir.
Can you imagine it with a mirrorless camera and a couple of lights?
Well, you know, you got to, it depends. It depends on, you know, what you're going to film. You know, if you're filming a documentary, you can do it with a DSLR. You know, you could even do like a play acting scenario with that kind of camera. When I was in NYU, we used a Filmo 16-millimeter film camera. We edited on some kind of, I try to remember the name of that device. You know, and we were able to make great short films, you know, with a very minimal of equipment and with very professional results.
Okay, but again, Lawrence of Arabia wasn't a documentary and certainly wasn't a short film. It was a beautiful film. The cameraman probably got an Oscar for it and deserved it. It was just an epic. Yeah, you got to pay some money for an epic. You can't do a cheap epic, unfortunately.
Yeah, but back in the old days, you know, you could get, you know, a whole field full of extras. You know, you could pay them a little something. And these days, if you want a huge crowd, you know, you have to somehow arrange to pay them. It would cost a lot more.
Now, the reality is that they don't pay anyone anything, almost. They have it digitally added. They fix it in post.
QSO, I really don't know so much about the extras on set, but when you talk about epics, then there's the consideration of having a lot of people
in the picture.
Yeah, and some can afford it and some can't. A Monty Python kind of made a joke out of it that they couldn't even afford a horse, so they had to...